Hello, everyone. Welcome to our edition today of Brain Trust Conversations in Clinical Psychopharmacology. I'm Dr. Joe Goldberg, clinical professor of psychiatry at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. We meet here every once or twice a month to chat with esteemed colleagues in clinical psychopharmacology to talk about topics that may or may not have gotten enough interest and attention in our learnings elsewhere, our readings elsewhere, but remain very important to patient care. So I hope you find this series useful. Our guest today is a longtime friend and colleague of mine, Dr. Henry Nasrallah. Let me introduce Henry and then tell you what we're going to talk about for the next 45 minutes or so. So many of you may know of Dr. Nasrallah. He's been in the field for a very long time. He's trained literally generations of psychiatrists over the course of time. Henry currently is vice chair for faculty development and mentorship and professor of psychiatry, neurology, and neuroscience at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. Henry has been a chair of psychiatry at two institutions, Ohio State University and then St. Louis University. He's been associate dean for faculty mentorship at the University of Cincinnati for 4 years. He's published extensively, primarily in the schizophrenia space, with over 450 scientific articles, 610 abstracts, 195 editorials, 13 books. Henry's the editor-in-chief of three journals: Current Psychiatry, Schizophrenia Research and Biomarkers in Neuropsychiatry. And I think, Henry, didn't you found Schizophrenia Research, the journal, I believe? And Henry also was the co-founder of the Schizophrenia International Research Society. He's a distinguished fellow of the APA. He's a fellow of the ACNP. He's been president of the Ohio Psychiatric Physicians Foundation, and has been very involved in patient advocacy. He's the executive vice president and scientific director of an organization called the, I want to pronounce it right, it's the CURES.
CURES, yes. It's an acronym for Comprehensive Understanding through Research and Education in Schizophrenia, CURES.
An important organization that Henry's been part of. So Henry, welcome to the program today. First and foremost, thanks for taking the time out to join us.
Thank you very much, Joe, and I appreciate this lengthy introduction. Let's get down to the nitty-gritty here.
Yes, so of the many things that we could be talking about today, I'm going to single out one topic, and this paper of yours, Henry, from a few years back, which is entitled An Analysis of the High Psychotropic Off-Label Use in Psychiatric Disorders. The majority of psychiatric diagnoses have no approved drug. Our topic today is going to be the off-label use of psychotropic medications and all the variations on that that range from what does it mean when a medicine is being used off-label? How does that comport with the scientific evidence base for it? How does on-label bear on proprietary branded compounds that a pharmaceutical manufacturer has a vested interest in for a very particular use? And what if you or I want to use it for something other than that? And if that's off-label, what does that mean? And how should patients think about this? So with that very broad backdrop, Henry, could you start us off and just how should our listeners be thinking about this concept of evidence-based and off-label?
Absolutely. This is a very important topic because off-label use of medications, proprietary medications that are approved by the FDA, has been going on for decades. And the reason I embarked on that paper that you just showed the audience with one of my fellows is because I was annoyed when a paper came out in Journal of Clinical Psychiatry. This was back, you know, about 15 years ago, implying that psychiatrists are acting inappropriately because 68% of all atypical antipsychotics were used off-label. So this was they collected the database from Medicaid, Medicare, I don't know which database. And it annoyed me because they don't understand the need for that. So this fellow of mine and I, we went through every drug ever approved by the FDA since 1960. And we listed them right next to the DSM-4 TR at the time, 300 psychiatric categories, diagnostic categories, and matched them for what diagnosis has an approved drug. And we ended up finding, as this paper shows, that 88% of psychiatric disorders do not have any approved drug. only 12% do. So what the heck do you do with 88% of the patients who show up in your clinic and have nothing approved? Take borderline personality as an example. You have to just do use medications that work on their symptoms, whatever symptoms they have, with depression, mania, brief psychotic episodes, et cetera, anger, et cetera. You use it judiciously, compassionately, and you treat them. You don't just send them away, say, sorry, I don't have any drug for you. This is true for other branches of medicine as well. And in fact, you know, I remember the FDA once sent out a statement a few years ago urging researchers to repurpose drugs, to take existing drugs and find new uses for them. We call it repurposing. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we do that all the time. So essentially, you know, off-label practice is essential for every practitioner who receives patients in their clinic. And our clinics are clogged by patients who are treatment resistant, did not respond to the approved drug. You gotta do something else, right? You cannot just let them suffer and eventually, you know, harm themselves or harm other people. So this is why off-label practice is an important key ingredient of general psychiatric practice.
Why do you think the pharmaceutical industry has not been so interested in that just about 90% of disorders for which there are no indications?
I think the real reason, in my opinion, is that they are not as prevalent and the pie is not big enough to bring in, you know, enough revenue, right? You got to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to develop a drug for a given condition. And if that condition is like 100,000 instead of 20 million for depression or 5 million for psychosis, whatever, I think this is, they never said that. I'm just guessing they just want to develop drugs for highly prevalent disorders. And there's a lot of disorders that are not that prevalent. They're not rare. I mean, rare diseases exist. There are 7,000 rare diseases in medicine. And the FDA usually rewards companies that develop drugs for one of those by allowing them to charge $400,000, $500,000 a year, which is ridiculously high. But those are disorders that exist like 5,000 or 10,000 in the country. Okay, so they need to get the return on investment. So that's why the FDA allows this huge cost. Some of the genetic, you know, gene altering drugs can cost $1 million or $2 million a year, actually, because it takes so long to develop. So that kind of answers the question. But there might be other reasons. I don't know. Why don't drug companies develop a medication for borderline personality? I keep saying that because it's so common. Mm-hmm. It is common. I mean, there's a lot of them, but I don't understand why they have not bothered with this disorder. They also don't bother with combination therapy. Many of them, you know, that want their drug to be approved. So a little bit of blame, but you know, I'm grateful to the drug companies that they spend so much time and effort. They're private enterprise. Without them, we will be dead in the water. We really need drug companies to continue working and not to demonize them and so on. That's why, you know, I serve as an advisor, consultant to several of them, and I tell them, this is what you should do. This is what this kind of design would work. Try this, try that. Giving them ideas from outside their companies can help them, I think.
So consider this. As far as I'm aware, there's one FDA-approved treatment for schizoaffective disorder. Right?
Yes.
We often use other, it's an atypical antipsychotic, we often use others, but technically that's off-label. If I've diagnosed a patient with schizoaffective and I'm not using Ingrezza, then I want to use anything else, even if it were clozapine, you know, it's off-label. How do I reconcile the fact that I'm borrowing from my scientific knowledge of how these drugs work, as opposed to saying, well, have you failed the one and only FDA approved drug for this particular ailment?
Yeah, there's only one drug approved for schizoaffective disorder, and that's paliperidone palmitate. But we use antipsychotics in general. You know, the FDA has a stupid policy that they started this like 20 years ago. Before that, it was much more broad. Like, they would develop an antipsychotic for patients with any psychotic symptoms. But about 20, 25 years ago, they decided no, a drug companies can only develop a drug for schizophrenia. Schizoaffective is a different disorder, even though they have very similar symptoms. Or delusional disorder. It's also psychotic, but it has to have a separate study. Now, this delays drug development because you have to do hundreds of millions, spend hundreds of millions and collect different kind of psychosis or drug-induced psychosis, etc. So this is, I think, part of the problem is that the FDA has several maybe unintentional obstruction to drug development that kind of leads to off-label practice. For example, one of the things that I wish the FDA would change their mind about is instead of demanding that a drug company do a clinical trial, a lot of studies, and culminating in a phase three clinical trial in a specific DSM diagnosis, okay, category, which is an artificial construct developed by a group of people around a table in a committee. It has very little validity, frankly, in the real world. But they decide that, okay, this company is going to develop drug for schizophrenia by DSM instead of using symptoms, indication for a symptom, like does the drug work for auditory hallucination or for delusion or impulsivity or depression or suicidality or anxiety, etc. I mean, if the FDA allows a change in the indication to symptoms, then nothing will be off-label anymore because that's what forces us to use medications off-label because there are symptoms existing in a disorder that doesn't have any approved drug. But that symptom resembles the symptom of another condition which does have a medication. So this is how we end up using off-label because it's rational.
So you're getting at two interesting points here. One is, let's say, dimensions of psychopathology, like you mentioned suicidality or maybe hallucinations or impulsivity or some target symptom that we're going after. And
Yes.
then the second is brain circuits. Let me start with this one first. The FDA, I think, has put a toe in the water with at least some drugs, for instance, in the autism space, when they'll talk about a drug like risperidone to treat agitation or aggression in
Correct.
autism.
Correct. That was an example of a symptom.
Why don't they do more? I know
They
you.
do more. They should do more.
Wouldn't that make sense? Because you could talk about to treat suicidal behavior in borderline personality disorder, or you could
Right.
treat micropsychosis or impulsive aggression. And these are
Right.
transdiagnostic concepts. I wonder
Correct.
if the FDA is sort of hesitant to go farther in that direction, even though that is exactly what I'm sure most of our clinician listeners today are doing in their own practices, whether they realize it or not.
Yes, and the FDA allows companies to have a secondary outcome. The primary outcome is, and say in schizophrenia, is improvement in psychosis, right? But they allow them to have a secondary outcome like negative symptom or cognitive deficits, okay, which is not a single symptom, but it's a category, a cluster of symptoms. But they haven't really focused on a specific symptom like alogia or bland, flat affect. Or anhedonia, etc. So, if only the FDA would loosen the rules a little bit, the whole notion of off-label becomes moot because we are allowed to use a medication for a symptom.
And to help us think less concretely about these things, if I may, let's take clozapine and the suicide, for example, right? So the only drug that has an FDA labeling that indicates it can reduce the chance of suicidal behavior, right, in schizophrenia.
Yes.
Now, if I'm concrete, I can't take that information and say, oh, I guess I should give clozapine to my suicidal depressed patient because the FDA, identified an anti-suicide effect specifically in that category. One would have to be mindful of the fact that probably the suicidality in schizophrenia comes from psychosis, whereas the suicidality in depression comes probably from other things besides that. So it really requires the clinician to think about what is going on in the brain as opposed to just saying, what does the label say, right?
Well, thank God the FDA allowed the manufacturer of clozapine to do a study called the INTERCEPT study that was started in 1999 and culminated in 2003 with an approval. And they focused on suicidality because there were observations that, hey, clozapine seems to reduce the suicidality in patients with schizophrenia. So they did a one-year study with against olanzapine, another good anti-atypical, okay, in terms of effectiveness, and but looked focused only on suicidality, suicide attempts, suicidal thoughts, etc. And lo and behold, clozapine beat the heck out of olanzapine at the end of the study, showing that it does have an efficacy on this symptom, suicidality. See, it paid off. And now all of us realize we got to use clozapine if our patient with schizophrenia is responding to one of the antipsychotics, but it's still suicidal. We can add clozapine. It's not only approved. I mean, I know it. We shouldn't only use it for treatment-resistant schizophrenia. We can add clozapine to patients who are responding to risperidone, olanzapine, or aripiprazole, whatever, but they're still suicidal. We can add clozapine strictly for that symptom. So now we solve the problem of label for suicide, at least.
So there's so many things we do in clinical psychopharmacology, I would venture to guess, without necessarily calling it out overtly or realizing it, along these lines. If I'm giving a patient valproic acid or lithium for their impulsive aggression, regardless of their diagnosis, and someone comes along and says, oh, but they don't have bipolar disorder. Or if I'm looking at affective instability, just moment-to-moment mood variations, and I have the observation that a particular medicine is helpful for that, I'm going in the off-label territory because I'm treating a target symptom that may or may not necessarily fall under the rubric of the overarching diagnosis. In my opinion, tell me what you think, that's exactly what we should be doing, even though the labeling and the way the FDA encourages us to think about these things goes in a different direction.
Right. You mentioned, you know, Depakote, bipolar, et cetera. We know that valproate works in bipolar disorder and reduces the manic symptoms, including especially the irritability, the anger, which is one of the hallmarks of bipolar. You have no idea how many patients I have in my neuropsychiatric clinic with traumatic brain injury who are angry, impulsive, and agitated, and I use Depakote for them right and left. They don't have any seizures. They don't have manic mania, but I use it specifically for that symptom and with great results, I must say. The patients themselves recognize it and thank me for it because they become less hostile, less angry, and getting along with people better. But we're doing it on our own, so it's called off-label. No company has done a study for irritability.
But Henry, you're also doing it based on your knowledge of neuroscience. And for our listeners, I'm wondering if they may be unwittingly doing something similar, but thinking about it wrong. Like they might say, so I gave this angry, impulsive patient valproate, and they seem less angry. Does that mean they have bipolar disorder? As opposed to Henry comes in and says, perhaps they have GABAergic dysfunction. Perhaps there's something in their limbic bottom-up regulation that's overriding top-down. And so you're using something that will have a kind of a pro-inhibitory effect in the brain. I mean, don't we want to try to encourage our colleagues to not think about the diagnosis unto itself as much as what do we think is going on in the brain?
You know, a few colleagues and I have been focusing on reinventing the DSM, okay? The DSM has a lot of silos with individual disorders arbitrarily and artificially defined, but it becomes the rule of the world. This is what this diagnosis is. But over the last 8 to 10 years, we now have ample evidence of the transdiagnostic model, which you mentioned earlier in one of your sentences. The transdiagnostic model shows that 14 different psychiatric disorders share many genes. So don't be surprised if your bipolar patient comes with ADHD or with panic disorder or with OCD or with alcohol use. This is absurd because it's absurd that we call these drugs, these disorders like a single disorder, but bipolar comes with a lot of corollaries attached to it genetically. This is called pleiotropy. And we really need to reinvent DSM to include all of those common comorbidities. And then guess what? We may eventually develop a drug that works across the board, a transdiagnostic drug. Clozapine is a good example, by the way. It works in psychosis, but it also works in mania, and it works in aggression, and it works in suicidality, and it works in depression, some people say. So this may be why a dirty drug like clozapine, which has numerous receptor binding, may actually be a transdiagnostic drug. We need more of that in the future.
You know, I'm so glad you said what you said, because I want to encourage our listeners to think about this very carefully. I think this is one of the most important things we do as practitioners. And I'd like to ask our listeners to think back to your more difficult patients. I'm assuming if you're watching this program, you must have at least a few difficult patients. How many have just a single diagnosis? They may have a primary diagnosis, but as Temi points out, Patients with serious mental illnesses, SMIs, usually have more than one thing going on. If you take out
Oh, yes.
DSM, you are allowed to diagnose as many things as you want, provided that a particular set of symptoms is not better accounted for by something else. So this is where
Right.
you could say, is inattention by virtue of comorbid ADHD, or are these the cognitive symptoms of depression or mania? Or is anxiety a subcomponent of depression, like anxious distress? Or is it a comorbid anxiety disorder? In the bipolar world that I study, 75% of people with bipolar illness have a second psychiatric diagnosis, 40% have a third, 20, about a quarter have three or more psychiatric diagnoses. So how
Yes.
the heck can you talk about on-label, off-label when you're treating four things?
Exactly. That's exactly the point. I think that the transdiagnostic model, I wish all clinicians would absorb that and realize that they're going to encounter a lot of so-called comorbidities. I call them coexisting. It's a really coexisting disorders. It's not a comorbility because they're being generated from the same genes probably that are shared by those disorders. And as you said, we have a lot of patients who are called treatment resistant, and they have multiple disorders. Not to forget the axis two, by the way. The personality disorder is
You'll have
another
to have that
big.
also.
It's a monkey wrench because people with the personality disorder respond less well to the drug that's approved for their condition. So when you look at the FDA studies, and you and I have done a lot of them, I'm sure. We basically collect patients that meet the diagnosis of X disorder, and they cannot have substance use. They cannot have diabetes. They cannot have tardive dyskinesia. They cannot have they cannot be homeless. They have to have a steady home, etc. All of those inclusion exclusion criteria, you end up doing a study on 300, 400 patients who are really stable, clean, without any medical or psychiatric comorbidities, and then you do the
Rarefied.
study. Yeah, exactly. They're in a very kind of clean sample, and you do the study, and guess what? It beats placebo. The drug goes to the market, approved for this condition. But then in the real world, the patients are messy. They are very, affected with multiple symptoms, multiple disorders, and this drug may or may not work for them. So we have to end up using some off-label method to make those real-world patients respond to a drug that might work for the clean and average patient. But frankly, our clinic is clogged with patients who don't respond to the standard drug.
So, not to beat up on the FDA or pharma, however, you're right. The model that now exists is to capture the rarefied monodiagnosis patient when, in fact, our colleagues in the clinical trenches aren't seeing those people. And so, when the results that occur in their hands are so different from what happens in the rarefied monodiagnosis patient, they throw their arms up. They say, this drug doesn't work, or there's something wrong with the trials. And yet, as you point out, the real world patients are not the ones that get studied. When we were doing the old studies of Depakote, I'm dating myself here. Bob Hirschfeld, our late colleague, published an interesting paper in Psychopharmacology Bulletin. He looked at all the screen failures for the Depakote clinical trials for the FDA. He found over 90% of the patients who were screened with bipolar to be in the study weren't eligible to be in the study. Now, just think about this.
Right.
90% of the people in the world who have this ailment aren't representative. And so they didn't get studied. And then when they come to you and to me and our colleagues, and because they have,
Exactly.
as you say, substance use disorder, eating disorders, PTSD, we don't know what to do with them. And we either have to go off label, or we have to say the on-label data falls short.
You know what also bothers me, Joe, is the different types of off-label. There's the most The baddest off-label in the eyes of the FDA is when you use a drug approved for condition X and you use it for condition Y. That's off-label. But what bothers me is another really innocuous off-label, which is using a medication above the approved limit in the FDA studies. Okay, so let's say olanzapine as an example. Okay, I mean when we did the studies with it. It came to the market with a dosage from 10 to 20. Okay, 20 was the highest dose used in the clinical trials, so FDA automatically makes it the upper limit. But in the real world, like we talked earlier, we have very difficult, complex, and severe patients who may need 25 and 30. And we go up that way and we end up getting some benefit. Even 35, 40 have been published actually showing olanzapine at 40 milligrams may act almost like clozapine.
Clozapine.
Yeah, but FDA says nope, in 20 is the upper limit. We are basically discovering other uses for these drugs at higher doses that were not included in the FDA study.
And you make me think, no, neither the FDA nor any other entity points out things like, look, if your patient is tolerating a medication without any meaningful adverse effects and they're not getting better, A, consider whether a supratherapeutic dose might be better. B, here's a novel idea. Check a blood level and see if
Yep.
they may be in the lower range of, it may not be the therapeutic reference range, but it can be an established reference range. And if somebody happens to be, for example, an ultra rapid metabolizer of a drug that's a substrate
Right.
for an enzyme that's under pharmacogenetic variation, you may be underdosing somebody without realizing it because they're at the lower end.
Yes. You know, speak of underdosing, here's another example. I like to use the low dose of Caplyta, which is lumateperone. It comes in 10.5 and 21. The company developed them for patients who have an inhibitor. So you're going to start with the lower dose, okay? But I find that they're very patient friendly to start Caplyta at 10.5 for a couple of days and 21 for a couple of days, and then go to the standard dose of 42, which is what the FDA approved, the only 42 milligrams. This is patient friendly, and the side effects, become more tolerable instead of basically hammering the patient with the full dose on day one. Which, and I got some side effects when you do that, and some patients, not all. And guess what? It's considered off label. Okay, the company will not give me samples of 10.5 and 21 to use, even though because it's off label to them. But it's off label in a very innocuous way. You're using a low dose initially, which I think should be used in most psychiatric disorders. So it titrates slowly to enter the brain of the patient in a very kind of friendly way so that you don't shock them with a full dose on day one.
And I think one can certainly be cognizant of the idea of tolerability issues can quickly clobber a trial. So the patient takes a medicine, and on day one or day two, they have a headache or they have something, or they're dizzy, and they don't want to continue it. And even if the target dose is here, and you know this is the target dose, the language of the label doesn't really say things like, you are welcome to use your clinical judgment and graduate up to that target dose. Now, if along the way someone is benefiting at a lower dose, there's no law that says you must go higher. And if they're not benefiting, but they're tolerating it and they're acclimating, you are now free to continue to the dose that was shown in the clinical trials, which may have been the dose that was studied, but we don't necessarily know if other doses might work better. Lilly never did a supratherapeutic dosing of olanzapine. That was just Katie, right? And that was
Yes.
almost an afterthought. So, what to
That's
do with
right.
a hard to treat non-responding schizophrenia patient or a bipolar patient? You can start low, go slow, but then how do you decide? This sort of brings us to, adequate trials. And if someone is on a low dose but they're tolerating it, we don't think let's go higher because we know a higher dose should work. And if they're still on a higher dose but it's not an optimized dose, sometimes a higher dose can work better. I guess there's a safety question that comes up too, because drugs with narrow therapeutic indexes, we have to be a little more cautious about. If my patient's on lithium with a level of 1.1 and they're
Right.
still symptomatic, I don't want to push that one too high. If someone's got a very high margin for concern about safety, the good prescriber understands safety first, but also recognizes, what's a reasonable balance of safety and efficacy.
Yes. And that you reminded me of another very common practice, off-label practice by many psychiatrists around the country and nurse practitioners, I guess, where they combine two or three antipsychotics, which is considered like bad polypharmacy, right? Because, hey, we don't have any studies to prove what you're doing is right. But those poor clinicians are trying to get their patient to respond. So they start with, let's say, risperidone, and they go to a pretty good dose, and the patient's psychosis continues. So they say, why don't I add some Geodon, for instance, okay? See if that helps. And guess what? After 2 weeks, a patient looks better. I think what they're doing is they're just increasing the amount of dopamine blockade in a difficult patient where the normal doses don't work and they may need a higher dose. But there are no studies. Nobody, not a single drug company has bothered to do a combination therapy, let's say antipsychotic A and B, or antipsychotic A, B, and C. 38% of the US patients with schizophrenia are receiving two or three or four antipsychotics, at least two. Okay, that's considered polypharmacy and it's stigmatizing, like it's bad. But there are some studies showing that maybe polypharmacy can actually be helpful. But I wish the companies will do a large double-blind placebo-controlled study comparing drug A alone by itself, another group getting A and B, and another group getting B only. Okay, so three to show that the A plus B was actually better than both of A and B. No need for placebo. You know, we do a non-inferiority study, which I mean, but nobody wants to put money to show that this might be helpful to a subset of patients that we encounter every day. Before we go to clozapine, maybe combining a couple of antipsychotics might be helpful. Well, nobody knows. It's being done clinically by a lot of clinicians in the real world, and they claim they're getting good results. Okay, but there's no evidence for it.
And experts like yourself, when you think about combinations and sort of using the materials that you have available, you will think about what makes sense. You know, it would make sense probably to you to augment clozapine with, say, aripiprazole, as opposed to quetiapine, right? Because you're just getting more antihistamine, anticholinergic effects, and you're not really doing anything unique, whereas the partial agonist makes sense. You can build a rationale for that. Now, there's two reasons why we're never going to see that study being adequately powered. One is I very much doubt the aripiprazole people, if they were still around, would want to show the limitations of the drug alone. And the second, and this is another important question, what happens once the drug goes generic? We're not going to see any more studies with aripiprazole or with lithium or with clozapine or anything that's adequately powered in the modern era. I have this gripe when it comes to antidepressants, because the only antidepressants that are getting studied at all nowadays are not tricyclics, are not SSRIs, are not even generic SNRIs. They're newer things. And so the current generation isn't going to have a way to know if, let's say, a drug like, I don't know, venlafaxine could work in OCD at high doses, because no one's going to study it.
That's right. Here's another issue I came to my mind. 30% of patients with schizophrenia will not respond to any dopamine antagonist, okay? So only 70% do, maybe even 65%. Mm-hmm. So we have about 30-35% who need clozapine, right? But many clinicians don't use it, unfortunately. You know, there's all kind of barriers. It's labor intensive, the patient doesn't want it, too many blood draws, and risk of death, and numerous side effects, even though it can be a lifesaver for many patients with treatment-resistant schizophrenia. About 47% will really get over their illness completely. It's like my patient, Bethany, with whom I established the Cures Foundation. Okay. I mean, she was totally psychotic for 5 years, dropped out of college, became psychotic and homeless, eating garbage on the street, food from the garbage, sleeping outdoors on a slab of concrete, and eventually hospitalized, treated with five different atypicals, nothing worked. And I said, what are you guys waiting for? I started her on clozapine, and within 8 weeks, 9 weeks, back to normal. The voices, command hallucinations disappeared. She went back to college and graduated with honors in molecular biology. Okay, that clozapine can be a lifesaver. But many, because it is so underutilized, about only 5% instead of 30% of schizophrenia patients go to have a clozapine trial, only 5% do. So why not at least try some other combinations for, like we said, either combinations of antipsychotics, although you mentioned the aripiprazole. I think that first study done adding aripiprazole to clozapine was to mitigate the metabolic side effects. And it seemed to help a little bit with lipids and glucose and whatnot. That was published a long time ago. But what I'm saying is, why aren't drug companies trying to help us have alternatives to clozapine, since it is so underutilized, and maybe we can go to another option off-label? Right now, we do a lot of off-label. I do a lot of off-label treatment for patients who fail clozapine, which is almost 50% or plus 50%, but I've salvaged almost 47%. The way what we do right now is we send them to ECT. ECT is the only way to work.
Yep.
And it doesn't work on everybody. It really helps another 50%. So great, wonderful. But many patients refuse to have ECT. Okay. So what I do off label, based on the literature, there are case reports, case series of lamotrigine. But in fact, you know, Dr. Tihonen in Finland wrote a meta-analysis of five studies showed improvement in patients who are clozapine failure. There are other patients who respond to reserpine. Other patients who respond to preservative, which is still being tested. There are another one. Allopurinol. Allopurinol is used, you know, for a completely different medical condition, and there are several reports showing that it can actually help patients with clozapine resistance. But nobody is bothering to do FDA type studies in order to get them to be approved, and clinicians may not be completely unaware that there are those options available. They're off label, and many clinicians don't want to use them, and many patients end up not getting anything. They're treatment resistant, not getting clozapine, and not getting ECT, and they wallow. And then we consider schizophrenia to be a hopeless illness, disabling illness, lower the expectation, nothing we can do about it. This is pervasive. We should never, ever give up on our patients with schizophrenia, as an example, or severe mania or severe depression, same thing with a TRD and so on. We need to have options approved. Thank God we have the esketamine, for instance, for treatment resistant depression. We have combinations approved now. But you're a mood disorders expert. You know, you have the option of switching or augmenting.
Yeah.
Okay. This is an eternal argument. Like, which one should I do first? And there are studies showing this one or this one is better. But these are still many of them. Were off label for a while until studies were done, and now we do them guided by controlled studies.
And then we do get limited by coverage. So here's a bugaboo of mine, ketamine, intravenous. It was first studied at NIMH in bipolar depression. It worked very nicely. Nobody got manic. But then when the manufacturer of intranasal esketamine did their registration trials, they chose to study unipolar, major depression, not bipolar patients. And so technically, if I wish to give that molecule to a patient and have it covered by insurance, they need to have unipolar depression, not bipolar depression. And it's not as if to say that it's a bad idea to use that molecule for bipolar depression, but it's off-label, which one implication is it won't be covered by insurance. What should we tell our colleagues who have to sort of wrestle with that coverage issue, or worse, to have the insurance company say, oh, this is not approved for that ailment, as if to make them think that it's a bad idea to try it.
Yes, that is one of the biggest stumbling block for the off-label issue, that insurance companies deny the usage of a medication that may help the patient off-label because it's off-label. Okay, I had a good example. I had a patient who failed every antidepressant on the market, failed ketamine, failed ECT, failed TMS, everything. And the only thing that worked for her, by chance, it was discovered by one of her clinicians, and then she was referred to me. The only thing that worked was modafinil, okay? Not 250, not 500. When she got to 1,000 milligrams a day, she woke up. Her depression was gone. Now, no drug company would approve it every time I prescribe it. It's completely off-label. It's not approved for depression, and it is a very high dose. Two off-labels, different conditions.
Yeah, dose and...
And a high dose. But, you know, I saved this woman's life by calling the drug company and explaining to them that her mother committed suicide. She might kill herself. This is the only thing that worked. All these drugs and ECT and ketamine IV did not work. What do you want to do? We have to save her life. So shut up and give us the modafinil. Okay, they don't want to approve it because they want to save money, basically. So don't forget the insurance company is a monkey wrench in the off-label practice.
It's funny you mentioned that example. I had a somewhat similar patient once with bipolar depression, and Mark Frey's study of modafinil in bipolar depression just come out. So I wanted to try it because I too had a resistant patient. And back then I think you could get samples. And so I gave this fellow samples. He was doing terrific, but then the samples came to an end, the drug went generic. And then when I tried to get it covered, not only did they not approve it, he'd been stable for years on this drug now,
wow.
But they sent him a letter saying something to the effect of, your doctor's giving you a drug that's not been shown to work. And the language sort of aroused concern on the patient's part that there was something not just off label, but sinister going on. And the patient looked at me and said, I don't understand. I'm better. I've been better. And they sent me a letter saying this has been shown to not work.
Yes.
And you have to explain to everybody involved the difference between something that's evidence-based, that's been shown to work, and then how the nuances of coverage
yes.
work.
See, what we're ending up recognizing is that off-label practices are legitimate. They're actually good for patients and saves a lot of lives, and preventing deterioration and chronicity and suicide, whatever. And you discover a drug that works for a patient off-label. You discover that it works, and the patient stabilizes and they feel good. And then the insurance company refuses to give it to the patient. Okay, but because it's off-label. So one of the stumbling blocks is the insurance companies don't care about the patient responding to an off-label drug. They just want to save money. And they force us to use one of the drugs that the patient already tried and did not respond to. But it's cheaper, right? They want us to use three generics before we go to a proprietary drug, which is because of cost. But again, that is a barrier to practicing off-label, rational off-label practices for a bunch of patients, 88%, who have nothing approved, as we said earlier.
Yeah.
And we're coming full circle here, that there is a whole bunch of patients in psychiatric clinics with no approved drug. And yet we discover by chance, and this is where I love clinicians who end up writing papers. There is so much wealth of knowledge by ordinary clinical psychiatrists who have a lot of challenging patients, and they try trial and error. They find that something works, but they never tell anybody. Unless you write it up as a case report or letter to the editor and share it with others, who will then say, oh yeah, I had something like that too. And pretty soon you have enough signals from a lot of clinicians that drug companies bring in their, their big capital and invest in a clinical trial. That's the only way we can start reducing the 88% who have nothing approved, because somewhere in the clinical arena, clinicians are using something for those patients that works, but it never sees the light of day because they don't disseminate it online. Nobody knows about it. Drug companies don't know about it, so they will not venture and invest money to do a clinical trial, a double-blind placebo-controlled trial.
Now, in fairness to the FDA, one of their missions is to protect from harm. And so let it not become the wild, wild west where you could do anything you want without respect to or cognizance of what the potential damages might be. So let's, for instance, imagine that I decided I'm going to treat Alzheimer's dementia with very high dose amphetamine because, in my opinion, I think that's a good idea. And it turns out not only is that off-label, it's not evidence-based, and you could run into other problems and get cardiovascular effects. So there we get into the dilemma that it's not just an off-label use. Is it a wise use? Is it a sensible use? And I humbly would say, here's where I think we can't necessarily count on the FDA to protect everyone from harm, but that the prescriber really has to understand what the drug is doing. And that's a big ask. Because it doesn't just mean I follow the label. It doesn't just mean, well, I know how the drug is prescribed. It means I understand what it's doing in the brain, both good and bad. And so if I decide, one other example, I was a patient once who was floridly manic, and the prescriber decided they were going to orally load them with lamotrigine because it's a mood stabilizer, sort of oblivious to the fact that lamotrigine has no mania properties. It's all for depression. And the patient ended up getting Stevens-Johnson syndrome and their mania didn't get better. And the poor clinician was saying, well, but the patient was so desperately ill, I did something off label. Well, he did something off label, but it also wasn't very logical because that's not the right tool for that job. So that wasn't about being off label. It was about rationale. So I guess as we're kind of winding down here, maybe you could share a few thoughts of wisdom with our listeners about how to think of what's logical. So it's not just random, I'll try this, I'll try that, but this makes sense and this doesn't make sense to try.
You know, Joe, I think we covered a lot of ground and I think we're running out of time. But here's what I want to end with.
Yeah.
That off-label practices, in my opinion, is a creative process and it's done by clinicians. not by researchers. Many of them are done by the hundreds of thousands of clinicians who need desperately trying to help a patient, and they discover something that works for them, which is completely off label. This is a to me, the cutting edge of scientific advances, the beachhead. If only they share it, though, if they only basically publish it, write it up, present it at a meeting, it is the moving edge of psychopharmacology when we discover off-label practices that eventually become on-label once a clinical trial is done. But first you have to show a signal and share it. Many clinicians say, I'm too busy to write things up. I wish they would, because some of the best ideas come from clinicians, and then they can partner with the researchers. It's a nice collaborative. We need both the clinicians and the researchers to address this issue of off-label.
You raise a really good point, and I'm not sure how many of our practitioner listeners are thinking about this, but you know, if you discover, like you described with the modafinil patient who did well at a high dose, write it up, send a letter to the editor, and you can present it as a hypothesis, and that will inspire other people, not necessarily to go and copy you, but to say,
yes.
Maybe something's going on here, because so much of psychopharmacology,
yes.
by history, is serendipitous discovery, right?
Right.
The MAO inhibitors from tuberculosis, lamotrigine's antidepressant properties came out of epilepsy. You know, we make observations. Good practitioners, good clinicians are really good observers.
Exactly.
And if you see something happen, write it up, send it in, and who knows, maybe someone will pick it up.
You know, I want to wrap up by giving you a non-psychopharmacology tidbit here.
Yeah.
Studies have shown, it's published, that when you do imaging on all the psychiatric disorders, I'm back to the transdiagnostic issue that I mentioned earlier. All the psychiatric disorders show the same deficit in on their brain MRI scans. Three regions. The same three regions are abnormal in all those disorders. Anterior cingulate, right insula, and left insula. Those three are abnormal across all psychiatric disorders, which tell you something about the brain. That being, they all share the same neurobiology. So no wonder they might share the same psychopharmacology. I mean, you know, this is a kind of a clue that there must be a way to treat all patients with one drug or two drugs that are approved for all of them. It's going to take a lot of off-label research to do that.
Yeah, but I think as long as the prescriber is asking the right questions, being cognizant, paying attention to efficacy and tolerability, and making some determination, is this helpful or not? That's really evidence-based practice.
Yes. Well, speaking of tolerability, though, I mean, a meta-analysis was done where they looked at the combination therapy and patients who don't respond to one antidepressant. They looked at all the studies where they were augmented with wellbutrin or aripiprazole or another antidepressant, and they found out, and it's published, that the best outcome for patients who don't respond to one antidepressant is not to add, let's say, wellbutrin to SSRI. They found that adding mirtazapine, Remeron, to a reuptake inhibitor, whether SSRI or SNRI, adding mirtazapine, which is an alpha-2 antagonist, a different mechanism completely, not only enhances the efficacy, but it also offsets the side effects. It offsets the side effects of SSRIs. Very interesting. So you have double benefit, more efficacy, which is what you're looking for, but patient tolerability also improves. This is the kind of studies that help guide clinicians about, I mean, there's no, it's not, it's off-label to use, you know, mirtazapine with Prozac or with Zoloft, whatever. But when they did the meta-analysis of studies that did that off-label, these clinicians are trying things here and there, and they write it up and publish it. We find that there is a signal that's worth disseminating and adopting.
Yeah, it's rationale-based, and it's asking the prescriber to think about what they're doing, which is what we hopefully all should be doing. Well, I think that's a good note to end on. Henry, I want to thank you so much for all your insights and your wisdom. You've certainly
been. My pleasure. It's fun to talk about things like this. The off-label is a controversial issue, but it really makes a lot of sense.
It should, and it really brings the prescriber to have to think about what they're doing, which is hopefully what we're doing anyway. So you've given us a lot to think about in terms of being mindful about one's practice, which is a goal. So I want to thank all of you joining us today. I hope you found this program helpful, and
very much.
Our series. We'll be back to see you again in the near future. So thank you for joining us today, and see you again next time.
Thank you.
Thank you. podcast is presented by Psychiatric Times, the number one psychiatric publication in the U.S. Visit us at psychiatrictimes.com for the latest clinical news, expert perspectives, and CME opportunities. Thank you for listening.